His honesty disarmed her for a moment, and she smiled and seemed to relax. They enjoyed a nice diversion, swapping stories about the challenges of practicing law in small-town America. When the time was up, John said warmly, "Tell me about Elaine. Job, salary, finances, family, and so on." "Well, as I said, she works part-time here for peanuts. She makes $24,000 a year as an assistant director of parks and rec for the city, not exactly a career job. She rents a modest apartment that she shares with her companion, Beverly, and drives a Nissan with a monthly note. Her family is from Erie, and I don't know how prosperous they once were, but things have taken a bad turn. She's on her own, 23 years old, surviving. She still has dreams of something beyond where she is now." John made a few notes, then said, "Yesterday I spoke with an attorney for the Tate family, big firm in Pittsburgh. Baxter had a trust that sent him $6,000 a month, which was never enough. That sum would increase over time, but all the Tate trusts are now tightly controlled by an uncle who has a rather heavy hand. Baxter's trust folded when he died. There's very little in his estate, so any contribution from his family would fall under the category of charitable giving. These people are not known for their charity, and it's hard to imagine them entertaining notions of writing checks to Baxter's old girlfriends." Mike was nodding in agreement. "What about Joey?" she asked. "He's working hard, trying to provide for a growing family. He's probably strapped, and will be for the rest of his life. My client would like to keep both Joey and Alan Strock out of this."
"That's admirable."
"We propose two payments, one now and one in 7 years, when the statute of limitations expires on the rape charge. If your client puts this behind her, gives up the idea of pursuing these guys, then she gets a nice payment at the end. $25,000 now, and for the next 7 years, my client will add $10,000 to an investment account that will render $100,000 when Elaine is 30 years old."
Same poker face.
"25 up front is ridiculous," she said.
"He doesn't have $25,000. It'll come from me."
"We're not too concerned about where it comes from. We're much more interested in the amount."
"Well, right now you have zero, and if we don't reach an agreement, then it's very likely you'll stay at zero. Your chances of recovery are slim at best."
"Then why are you offering anything?"
"Peace of mind."
"Mike, come on.
Let's put this baby to sleep so these kids can get on with their lives. Kyle had almost forgotten the incident. Hell, he's working 100 hours a week. Then Joey bumps into Elaine, then Baxter shows up all consumed with guilt because he remembers more now than he did before. This is crazy. We're just a bunch of drunk kids."
Yes, they were, and Mike couldn't argue the point.
She recrossed her legs, and John was compelled to glance at the high heels. Just a quick down and up, but she noticed it.
"Let me talk to Elaine, and we'll make a counteroffer," she said.
"Fine, but there's not much wiggle room here, Mike. The upfront money will be a loan from me to my client, and he's obviously nervous about taking on a 7-year obligation. He's 25 and can't see 3 years down the road."
"I'll call Elaine, and she'll probably want to run over and discuss this face to face."
"I'm not leaving town until we have a deal. I'll just walk down to the coffee shop and kill some time."
An hour later, he was back. They took their same positions, picked up their pens, and continued the negotiations.
"I assume you're not taking our offer," John said.
"Yes and no. The 7-year scheme is okay, but Elaine needs more up front. She is 2 years away from her degree at the University of Scranton. Her dream is law school, and without some help, it will be impossible."
"How much help?"
$100,000 now."
Shock, disbelief, amazement, rejection. John grimaced and squirmed and allowed a lungful of air to whistle over his teeth.
It was all an act, the long-practiced pretense of utter incredulity when the other side puts its first demand on the table.
Exasperation,
near defeat.
"Look, Mike, we're trying to reach an agreement here. You guys are trying to rob a bank."
"In 2 years, Elaine will still be earning $24,000 a year. Your client, on the other hand, will be earning about $400,000 with guaranteed increases. This is not a stretch for him."
John stood as if he were leaving. End of negotiations. "I need to call him."
"Sure, I'll wait." John walked outside the building, put a cell phone to his head, and called no one. The amount they would pay had less to do with what Elaine needed and much more to do with keeping her quiet. $100,000 was a bargain under the circumstances. "We'll go $75,000, and that's it," John said, back at the table. Her right hand rattled pleasantly as it came across. "Deal," she said. They shook on their agreement, then spent 2 hours haggling over the paperwork. When it was finished, he offered to buy lunch, and she readily accepted. Chapter 37. Nigel's latest workstation had been hastily assembled on a fine mahogany desk in the center of the sitting room in a spacious suite at the Waldorf Astoria on Park Avenue. The computer was a 16-by-20-inch exact replica of the 10 models on the 18th floor. The monitor, too, was a perfect match. Next to it was an ominous navy blue box the size of a larger laptop. As Nigel proudly went through a detailed description of the various cords and cables, the spaghetti, as he called it, Benny and Kyle watched without a word. There was a power cord, audio, monitor, and printing cables.
"Audio, Kyle. Do we have noise from these bad little boys?"
"No, no audio," Kyle replied. And Nigel carefully rolled up the audio cable and put it away. He bent low behind the computer and pointed to the magic spot.
"Here we are, Kyle. The promised land. The USB port. Almost hidden, but I know it's there because I have a contact with Fargo. It has to be there, trust me."
Kyle grunted, but said nothing.
"Here's the plan, Kyle,"
he said excitedly, thoroughly enthralled by his work. From his neat little hacker's high-tech toolkit, he produced two small devices, identical in shape and length, 3/4 inch wide and about 1.5 inches long.
"This is the wireless USB transmitter, hot off the press, state of the art, not yet available to the public."
"No, sir," he said, then quickly plugged it into the port that was under the power inlet. Once it was inserted, about 1/2 inch could be seen.
"You plug it in just so, and presto, we're in business. It's virtually invisible."
He waved the other and explained,
"And this little booger is the USB receiver that goes in the blue box there. With me, Kyle?"
"Got it."
"The blue box goes inside your briefcase. You park the briefcase on the floor, directly under the computer, flip a switch, and the docs get themselves downloaded in a jiffy."
"How fast?"
60 megabytes per second, about 1,000 documents, assuming you get the receiver within 3 meters of the transmitter, which should be easy."
"The closer, the better, Kyle.
Are you with me?"
"Hell no," Kyle said as he sat in the chair in front of the monitor. "I'm supposed to somehow reach behind the computer, plug in the transmitter, leave it there, download, etc., while there are other people in the room and the video cameras are watching? How exactly do I pull that off?" "Drop a pen," Benny said. "Spill some coffee. Throw some papers around. Create a diversion. Go when the place is empty, and keep your back to the camera." Kyle was shaking his head.
"It's too risky. These people are not stupid, you know. There's a security tech on duty in a room next door. Name's Gant."
"But does he work 16 hours a day?"
"I don't know when he works. That's the point. You never know who's in there watching."
"We know security, Kyle, and the grunts who are paid to watch closed-circuit screens all day are usually half asleep. It's terribly boring work."
"This is not a coffee room, Benny. I'm supposed to be working in there. Stealing may be a priority for you boys, but the firm expects me to be plowing through the documents. I'll have a project due and a partner waiting on it."
Nigel charged in.
"It could be over in 2 hours, Kyle, assuming you can find the documents quickly."
Benny shook off all concerns. "Priority one is the air-breathing engines that Trilon and Barton developed together. The technology is so sophisticated that the Pentagon is still orgasmic. Priority two is the fuel mix. Do a search for cryogenic hydrogen fuel and follow it up with one for scramjet. There should be a ton of research in the files. Priority three is called wave riders. Do a search. These are aerodynamic designs used to increase the B-10's lift-to-drag ratio. Here's a memo." Benny handed over a 2-page summary.
"Any of this sound familiar, Kyle?"
Nigel pleaded.
No. It's there, Benny insisted. It's the heart of the research, the crux of the lawsuit. And you can find it, Kyle.
Oh, thank you. For practice, Nigel withdrew the transmitter and handed it to Kyle.
Let's see you do it.
Kyle slowly got to his feet, leaned over the computer, shoved away some cables, and with some effort finally managed to insert the transmitter into the USB port. He sat down and said,
There's no way.
Of course there is, Benny scoffed.
Use your brain.
It's dead.
Nigel bounced around to the blue box.
The software is some of my home brew. When you have inserted the transmitter, you reach down and flip this little switch, and the script automatically locates the computer and begins downloading the database. It will happen very quickly, Kyle. And if you like, you can take a break, leave the room, go for a pee, act like nothing at all is happening. And all the while, my little gizmo is sucking up the documents.
Bloody brilliant, Kyle said. Benny produced a black Bally briefcase identical to Kyle's, a stand-up model with a short leather flap that latched on one side. There were three compartments, with the middle one padded for a laptop. The substitute was complete with a few scuff marks and Kyle's Scully and Pershing business card firmly in the leather tag.
You'll use this, he said as Nigel carefully lifted the blue box and placed it in the center compartment of the briefcase.
When you unzip this divide, Nigel said, the receiver will already be in place. If for some reason you need to abort, just close the case and punch this button, and it locks automatically.
Abort?
Just in case, Kyle.
Let me get this straight. Something goes wrong, somebody notices me, maybe some alarm goes off in a supercomputer we know nothing about as soon as I start dickering with the database, and your plan is then for me to lock the flap on the briefcase, grab the transmitter that's almost hidden, and then do what? Sprint from the room like a shoplifter who's been caught? Where do I go, Nigel? Any help here, Benny?
Relax, Kyle, Benny said with a fake smile.
This is a piece of cake. You'll do fine.
No alarms, Kyle, Nigel said. My software is too good for that. Trust me.
Would you please stop saying that?
Kyle walked to a window and looked out at the Manhattan skyline. It was almost 9:30 on Tuesday night. He had not eaten since he and Tabor had enjoyed a 15-minute lunch in the firm cafeteria at 11:30. Hunger, though, was only a minor concern on a long, sad list.
Are you ready, Kyle?
Benny called from across the room. Not a question, but a challenge.
As ready as I'll ever be, he answered without turning around.
When?
As soon as possible. I want to get it over with. I'll stop by the room a few times tomorrow, check the traffic. My best guess is that it'll be about 8 tomorrow night, late in the day, but with enough time to download, assuming I don't get shot.
Any questions about the equipment, Kyle?
Nigel asked.
Kyle walked stiffly back to the workstation and stared at the machines. He finally shrugged and said,
No, it's pretty straightforward.
Super. One last thing, Kyle. The blue box has a wireless signal, so that I know precisely when you're downloading.
Why is that necessary?
Monitoring. We'll be very close by.
Another shrug. Whatever.
The blue box was still in the center compartment, with Nigel handling it as if it were a bomb. Kyle then added the materials from his own briefcase, and when he grabbed the handle and lifted it off the table, he was surprised at the weight.
A bit heavier, Kyle,
Nigel quizzed, watching every move.
Yes, quite a bit.
Not to worry. We've reinforced the bottom of the bally. It's not going to drop out as you're walking along Broad Street.
I like the other one better. When do I get it back?
Soon, Kyle, soon.
Kyle pulled on his trench coat and made his way to the door. Benny followed and said,
Good luck, Kyle. It's all come down to this.
We believe in you.
Go to hell, Kyle said, and left the room.
Chapter 38. The briefcase grew heavier during the short, sleepless night, and when Kyle lugged it out of the rear of the taxi early Wednesday morning, he half wished the bottom would indeed fall out, the blue box would crash onto Broad Street in 1,000 pieces, and Nigel's precious home brew would be sent down the gutter. He wasn't sure what would happen after that, but any scenario was far better than what was planned. 20 minutes after he rode the elevator to the 34th floor, Roy Benedict entered the same elevator with 2 young men who were undoubtedly associates at Scully and Pershing. The signs were obvious. They were under 30. It was 6:35 in the morning. They appeared to be fatigued and miserable, but they wore expensive clothes and carried handsome briefcases, black. He was prepared to see a familiar face, though felt it unlikely. It was not at all unusual to see attorneys from other firms in the building. Roy knew 6 partners at Scully, but with 1,500 lawyers arriving for work, he figured the odds were slim. And he was right. The 2 zombies riding up with him were just a couple of faceless souls who would be gone in 1 year or so. The briefcase in Roy's hand was also a black Bally, identical to the one Kyle bought back in August, the 3rd one required for this mission. He left the elevator alone on the 34th floor and walked past the vacant reception desk, down a hall to the right, 4, 5, 6 doors, and there was his client, sitting at his desk, sipping coffee, waiting. The exchange was brief. Roy swapped briefcases and was ready to go. "Where are the feds?" Kyle asked, very softly, though no one was in the hall and the secretaries were just getting out of bed. "Around the corner in a van. They'll do a quick scan to make sure there are no tracking devices. If they find one, I'll bring it back in a sprint and we'll concoct a story. If not, then they'll take it to their lab in Queens. This thing is heavy. The blue box, specially designed by some evil geniuses. When do you need it? Let's say 7 p.m. That's 12 hours. Should be enough, right? That's what they say. According to Bullington, they have a small army of geeks just itching to unwrap it. They can't screw it up. They won't. You good? Great. Do they have arrest warrants? Oh, yes. Wiretapping, extortion, conspiracy, lots of good stuff. They're just waiting on you. If Benny is about to be arrested, then I'm a motivated young man. Good luck. Roy was gone, leaving behind the Bally with the same scuff marks and name tag. Kyle quickly stuffed it with files and legal pads and pens, and went to find more coffee. 12 long hours later, Roy was back with the 2nd briefcase. He took a seat as Kyle closed the door. So? He said. It is what it is. It's a customized computer built along the lines of those used by the military. Everything is heavy duty. Designed for nothing but downloading. 2 hard drives with 750 gigabytes each. Basically enough memory to store everything in this building and the 3 next door. Highly sophisticated software that the FBI geeks have never seen before. These guys are good, Kyle. Tell me about it. And there is indeed a wireless signal so they can monitor you. Damn it. So I have to download something. I'm afraid so. The wireless signal cannot indicate what you are downloading or how much. It just lets them know that you're inside and that you've started moving the database.
Shit! You can do it, Kyle.
That seems to be the consensus.
Do you know where you'll meet these guys?
No. It'll be a last-second notice. Assuming I download without setting off alarms, I'll call Benny with the happy news and he'll tell me where to meet. I'm going to the room in 1 hour, and I plan to quit at 9, regardless of the download. So by 9:15, if I'm lucky, I should be on the street. I'll stay at my office. If you get a chance, please call. Pretty exciting stuff, Kyle.
Exciting? How about terrifying?
You're the man.
With that, Roy exchanged briefcases again and disappeared. For 60 minutes, Kyle stared at the clock, did nothing but build Trilon for 1 hour, and finally made a move. He loosened his tie, rolled up his sleeves, tried to look as casual as possible, and took the elevator to the 18th floor. Sherry Abney was in the room, and he had to say hello. From the looks of her table, she'd been there for hours, and the research had not gone well. Kyle chose a station as far away from her as possible. Her back was to him. Despite his bitching and moaning, he foresaw little danger of being noticed by another member of Team Trilon. All 10 chairs faced the outside walls, away from the center, so that while doing research, he could see nothing but the monitor, the computer, and the wall behind it. The danger was up above, lurking in the lenses of the video cameras. Still, He preferred to have the room to himself. After 15 minutes, he decided to visit the men's room. On the way out, he asked Sherry, "Can I get you a coffee?"
"No, thanks. I'm leaving soon."
Perfect. She left at 8:30, a nice breaking point that always made billing easier. Kyle placed a legal pad on top of the computer, then a couple of pens, things that could roll and slide and need retrieving. He scattered a couple of files beside the monitor and in general made a mess of things. At 8:40, he knocked on the locked metal door that led to the small printing room, and there was no answer. Then he tried a second metal door that led to places unknown, but he suspected it was the room where Gant hung out and secured things. He saw Gant occasionally and figured he worked close by. There was no answer. At 8:45, Kyle decided to plunge ahead before another associate arrived for one last hour of work. He walked to his table and bumped the legal pad on top of the computer, sending the pens flying against the wall. He threw up an arm, said, "Shit!" as loudly as possible, then leaned over as if to retrieve things. He found one pen, couldn't find the other, but kept searching. On the floor, behind the monitor, under the chair, then again behind the computer, where he deftly inserted the tiny transmitter into the USB port just as he found the missing pen and held it up so the cameras could see it. Settled down now, composed, not cursing, he took his seat and began clicking away at the keyboard. He slid the briefcase closer under the table, directly under the computer now, then he flipped the switch. No alarms, no virus warnings screaming from the screen, no sudden entry by Gant with armed guards. Nothing. Kyle the hacker was downloading files, stealing at a dizzying rate of speed. In 9 minutes, he transferred all Category A documents, letters, memos, 100 different varieties of harmless information that had already been submitted to Ape and Barton. When he was finished with the Category A documents, he repeated the process and downloaded them again. And again, and again. An hour after he entered the room, he again went through the charade of searching for lost pens, and while bumbling about, he plucked the transmitter from the USB port. Then he cleaned up his mess and left. He hurried to his office, got his jacket and trench coat, and made it to the elevators without seeing another person. As he rode down without a single stop, he realized that this was the moment he had always feared. He was leaving the office as a thief, with enough stolen files in his briefcase to get him convicted of numerous crimes and disbarred for life. As he stepped into the raw December night, he immediately called Benny. "Mission accomplished," he said proudly. "Great, Kyle. Oxford Hotel, corner of Lex and 35th, room 551, 15 minutes away." "I'm on the way." Kyle walked to a black sedan, one duly registered to a well-known car company in Brooklyn, and jumped into the back seat. The small Asian driver said, "Where to?" "And your name is?"
"Al Capone."
"Where were you born, Al?"
"Tutwiler, Texas."
"You're the man, Al. Oxford Hotel, room 551. Al, the agent, immediately called someone and repeated the information. He listened for a few minutes, drove very slowly, then said, "Here's the plan, Mr. McAvoy. We have a team on the move, and they should be at the hotel in 10 minutes. We'll take our time here. When the supervisor is in the hotel, he will call me with more instructions. Would you like a vest?"
"A what?"
"A vest, bulletproof. There's one in the trunk if you'd like." Kyle had been too preoccupied with his thievery to contemplate the actual events surrounding the arrest of Benny, and hopefully Nigel, too. He was sure he would lead the FBI to his handler, but he had not given much thought to the details of his betrayal. Why exactly might he need a bulletproof vest? To stop bullets, of course. Baxter flashed through his overheated brain. "I'll pass," Kyle said, realizing how ill-equipped he was to make such decisions.
"Yes, sir."
Al looked for traffic, for detours, anything to burn some clock. His cell phone rang and he listened, then said, "Okay, Mr. McAvoy, I'll stop in front of the hotel and you'll walk into the lobby alone. Go to the elevators to the right and punch the button for the fourth floor. Get off on the fourth, turn left, walk to the door leading to the stairs. In the stairwell, you will meet Mr. Bullington and several other agents. They will take over from there."
"Sounds like fun."
"Good luck, Mr. McAvoy." 5 minutes later, Kyle walked into the lobby of the Oxford Hotel and followed his instructions. In the stairwell between the fourth and the fifth floors, he met Joe Bullington and two other agents, all dressed exactly like the ones who'd snatched him some 10 months earlier after a youth basketball game in New Haven. Except these were real, and he had no desire to inspect their credentials. Tensions were high, and Kyle's weary heart was pounding furiously.
"I'm Agent Booth. This is Agent Hardy," one said,
and Kyle was impressed with how large they were.
"Go to the door of 551, Booth said. "The second it starts to open, kick it very hard, then jump back out of the way. We'll be right behind you. We do not anticipate gunfire. We assume they're armed, but they're not expecting trouble. Once we're inside, you'll be removed from the scene."
"What? No gunfire?" Kyle started to crack a funny, but his knees were suddenly weak.
"Got it,"
Booth growled at him. "Got it. Let's go." Kyle entered the hall and walked with as much confidence as possible to room 551. He pressed the button, took a deep breath, and glanced around. Booth and Hardy were 15 feet away, ready to spring, shiny black pistols drawn. From the other end of the hall, two other agents were approaching, also with guns visible. Maybe I should have opted for the vest, Kyle thought. He pressed the button again. Nothing. Not a voice from within. Not a sound. His lungs had ceased working, and his stomach was a mess. The briefcase weighed a ton, much heavier now that it contained the stolen files. He frowned at Booth, who looked perplexed as well. Kyle pressed the button for the third time, then tapped on the door and yelled, "Hey, Benny! It's Kyle!" Nothing. He rang the doorbell for the fourth time, then fifth.
"It's a single room," Booth whispered.
Then he motioned for some type of well-rehearsed formation and said to Kyle,
"Please step aside. Go right down there and wait."
Hardy whipped out an electronic room key and inserted it. The green light came on, and the four FBI agents stormed in, high and low, right and left, barking, guns aimed in all directions. Joe Bullington was running toward them, and behind him were more agents. The room was empty. Of suspects, anyway. And if anyone had been there recently, he'd left nothing behind. Bullington reappeared in the hall and commanded, "Lock the building!" into a phone or walkie-talkie. He shot Kyle a look of complete astonishment, and Kyle began to fade. Agents hustled about, frantic with indecision and confusion. Some ran to the stairs, others to the elevators. An old woman in 562 stepped into the hall and shouted,
"Quiet!"
but quickly lost her spunk when two frowning agents spun around with weapons. She retreated quickly, unharmed but awake for the night.
"Kyle, here please," Bullington said, waving him into room 551.
Kyle clutched the briefcase and entered the room.
"Stay here for a few minutes," Bullington said. "These two will remain with you."
Kyle sat on the edge of the bed, briefcase between his feet, as his two guards closed the door and put away their guns. Minutes passed as he thought of 100 scenes and scenarios, none particularly appealing. He thought of Roy and called him. He was still at his office, waiting for the news.
"They got away," Kyle said, his voice slow and weak. "What do you mean?"
"We're in the hotel room, and it's empty. They're gone, Roy."
"Where are you?"
"Room 551, Oxford Hotel. Under guard, I guess. The FBI is searching the hotel, but they won't find anybody."
"I'll be there in 15 minutes.
While the hotel was being searched, three FBI agents entered Kyle's apartment in Chelsea. Using his key, they entered quietly and began a sweep that would take 4 hours and produce three hidden cameras, a wiretap on his wall phone, and six other eavesdropping devices. Plenty of evidence to support indictments. A strong case for the feds. But what they really needed was some suspects.
Chapter 39. Roy arrived at 11 p.m. He was met by Joe Bullington at the front door and escorted through the lobby. The hotel was still locked down, a room-by-room search underway with lots of unhappy guests, and the front desk was chaos. Roy's first question was, "How's Kyle?"
"Pretty rattled," Bullington said. "Let's take the stairs. The elevators have been stopped. Hell, we're all rattled."
The second question was the most obvious one.
What happened?
I do not know, Roy. It's confusing. Kyle was seated on the edge of the bed, briefcase still between his feet, trench coat still on, staring blankly at the floor and ignoring the two agents who were guarding him. Roy put a hand on his shoulder, then knelt down to face level and said, Kyle, you okay? Sure. It was somewhat helpful to see a trusted face. Bullington was on the phone. He slapped it shut and said, Look, there's a suite on the second floor. It's easier to secure and much larger. Let's make a move. As they filed out, Kyle mumbled to his lawyer, Did you hear that, Roy? Easier to secure. I'm being protected now. It's okay, Kyle. The suite had three rooms, one of which would work well as an office, desk, fax, wireless internet, several comfortable chairs, and a small conference area at the far end. This'll do, Bullington said as he ripped off his trench coat, then his jacket, as if they would be there for some time, and Kyle and Roy did the same. They took their seats and settled in. Two younger agents stayed by the door. Here's what we know so far, Bullington began, very much the special agent in charge. The room was reserved this afternoon by a Mr. Randall Kerr, who used both a bogus name and a bogus credit card. Around 8:45, Mr. Kerr shows up to check in alone, one small carry-on and a black briefcase, and in chatting up the desk clerk tells her that he just flew in from Mexico City. We've watched the video. It's Benny, with no effort at disguise. He went to his room, and according to the electronic entry grid, he opened the door to room 551 at 8:58. He opened it again 18 minutes later, leaving, evidently, because the door was never used again. No one remembers seeing him exit the building. There are some video cameras in the hallways and lobby, but so far nothing. He's vanished.
Of course he's vanished, Kyle said. You won't find him.
We're trying.
What did you download, Kyle? Roy asked. The Category A documents, 5 or 6 times. I didn't touch anything else.
And this went smoothly?
As far as I know, there were no problems inside the room.
What time did you start downloading? Bullington asked.
About 8:45.
And what time did you call Benny?
Just before 10.
Bullington thought for a second, then stated the obvious.
So Benny waited until they got your signal, and once he knew you were downloading, he checked into the room. 18 minutes later, he fled. That doesn't make sense.
It does if you know Benny, Kyle said.
I don't follow, Bullington said.
Someone informed Benny of our little plan. That much is obvious. It wasn't me, it wasn't my lawyer, and the only other parties involved would be you, Mr. Bullington, the FBI, and Mr. Wingate and his gang over at Justice. We have no idea at this point, and we probably never will. Regardless, Benny got the tip and decided to have some fun. He knew I would lead you here to catch him, so this is all a setup. Benny's probably down the street watching 100 FBI agents swarm around the hotel and laughing his balls off. Bullington's cheeks turned a dark red. He suddenly had a call to make and left the room.
Take it easy, Kyle, Roy said softly.
Kyle locked his fingers behind his head and bent over. The briefcase was still wedged between his feet. He closed his eyes and tried to control his thoughts, but that was impossible. Roy watched him but said nothing. He went to the minibar and pulled out 2 bottles of water.
We should talk, Roy said, handing a bottle to Kyle. We'll have to make some quick decisions.
Okay.
What do we do with this damned thing? Kyle asked, patting the briefcase.
Scully doesn't need it because the documents are not confidential. I just stole a copy. They haven't lost anything yet. Their files will appear to be untouched.
I'm sure the FBI will want it for evidence.
Evidence against who?
Benny.
Benny? Benny's gone, Roy. Listen to me. They'll never find Benny because he's a hell of a lot smarter than they are. Benny won't be arrested. Benny won't go to trial. Benny's on an airplane right now, probably a private one, looking at his 15 passports and deciding which one to use next.
Don't be so sure.
And why not? Benny outfoxed us tonight, didn't he? Benny has pals in high places. Maybe not here in New York, maybe in Washington. Too many people got involved, Roy. The FBI, the Department of Justice, and the network of gossip spread. Plans here, authorizations there, meetings at high levels, more and more intelligence people in the loop. It was a mistake.
You had no choice.
My choices were limited. Looks like I made the wrong one.
What about the law firm? I'm sure I'll screw that up, too. What's your advice? God knows I'm paying for it, if even at a discount.
Both managed smiles, but very brief ones. Roy gulped his water, wiped his lips with a shirt sleeve, and leaned even closer. The two guards were still in the sitting room, within earshot.
You could say nothing. Just report tomorrow for duty and act like none of this happened. The files are safe. Nothing has been compromised. Look, Kyle, you never planned to hand over anything to Benny. You were forced to download some stuff to facilitate his arrest. The arrest didn't happen. The firm has no clue. Assuming there won't be a prosecution, the firm will never know.
But the plan was to bust Benny, tell the firm everything, and beg for mercy.
Sort of like the bank robber who brings back the cash and says he's sorry, can't we just forget about it? With a few more twists, of course. Do you want to stay at the firm, Kyle?
My exit from Scully and Pershing was a foregone conclusion the day I walked into your office.
There might be a way to save the job.
I took the job because Benny had a gun to my head. That gun has now been replaced by a different one, but at least the threat of blackmail is gone. There's a chance the video may still cause some embarrassment, but nothing more. I'd like to get out of here. A radio squawked in the sitting room, jolting the agents. It came and went with no further news. Kyle finally abandoned the briefcase and stretched his legs. He looked at his lawyer and said, "You're a big partner in a big firm. What would you do if an associate pulled this stunt?"
"Fire him immediately."
"Exactly. On the spot, with little patience for a lot of talk. How can the firm ever trust me again? There are 1,000 rookies out there ready to replace me. And there's something else here, Roy. Something that Scully needs to know." Kyle glanced at the sitting room, where his bodyguards were now watching TV. "I'm not the only spy. Benny knew too much. Someone else is planted there, passing along information to Benny. I have to tell them." There was a commotion at the door, and the two guards quickly muted the television and hopped to attention. Kyle and Roy stood as Bullington swept in with a small, important group, the center of which was a man of about 60 with short gray hair, a fine suit, and the air of someone in complete control of all things around him. Bullington introduced him as Mr. Mario Delano, director in charge of the New York office of the FBI. He addressed both Kyle and Roy.
"Gentlemen, Mr. Benny Wright has obviously left the building, and we have a serious problem. I have no idea where the leak was, but I assure you it was not my office. I doubt that's very comforting right now. We are searching frantically around the city, train stations, airports, subways, heliports, toll roads. Every agent under my authority is on the streets."
If Kyle was supposed to be impressed, he was not. He simply shrugged as if to say, "Big deal, the least you could do." Delano pressed on.
"It's urgent that you get out of town, Mr. McAvoy. I suggest that we take you into protective custody for a few days. Let the dust settle. Give us some time to track down Benny Wright."
"And if you don't find him?" Kyle asked.
"Let's talk about that later. We have a small jet waiting at Teterboro Airport. We'll have you there in 30 minutes. You'll have protection around the clock until something changes."
The crisp precision of Delano's plans left no doubt that the dangers were indeed substantial. Kyle could not argue. He was now the double agent, as well as the government's star witness in the event Benny got caught. If they would murder Baxter to keep him away from Elaine, it was hard to imagine what they would do to Kyle.
"Let's go," Delano said.
"I need a minute with my client," Roy said.
"Certainly," said Delano as he snapped his fingers and the room emptied.
Roy closed the door, and when they were alone, he said, "I'll call Scully and put them off." Kyle withdrew his firm phone and said,
"No need. I'll check in with Doug Peckham and tell him I'm sick. Benny never got his hands on my little phone here."
"Fine. It's best if I keep the briefcase in the computer. Just don't let the FBI have it."
"I won't."
They shook hands. Roy said,
"You did the right thing."
"Right or wrong, it didn't work."
"You didn't hand over anything, Kyle. You didn't breach a client's confidence."
"Let's argue later."
"Be safe."
Chapter 40. John McAvoy was enjoying a peaceful Thursday morning at his desk when a secretary rang in with the news that two gentlemen from the FBI had dropped by for a surprise visit. They were quickly shown in. Introductions were made, badges flashed, coffee declined.
"Is he all right?" John asked.
"He's fine," the agent named Halsey said.
The one named Murdoch agreed, nodding with smug assurance.
"What's happened?"
Kyle has informed us that you are aware of the plans he had to help apprehend his handler, Halsey said.
Yes, I know the background and I know what he had in mind. What's happened?
Both agents shifted weight. Murdoch took over.
Well, things didn't go as planned. Kyle secured the documents and he was supposed to meet the handler around 10 last night in a Midtown hotel. The handler didn't show, fled at the last moment. As of now, we have not apprehended him.
John closed his eyes, removed his reading glasses, and lit a cigarette. Where's Kyle?
He's with us, in protective custody. He's safe, and he's anxious to talk to you. That will not be possible at this moment.
A blast of blue smoke escaped from John's side of the desk. Protective custody? He repeated. The smoke drifted over and began settling on Halsey and Murdoch.
Afraid so. He could be in danger.
Who botched the operation?
Not sure it was botched, or how, or why. Let's just say there is a lot of investigating going on right now.
When can I talk to him?
Soon, Halsey said.
We're out of Philly, Murdoch said. But we're here in York for the next few days. Our job is to relay messages to you.
Both agents withdrew business cards.
Cell numbers on the back. Please don't hesitate to call.
Kyle slept late into the morning and awoke to the sounds of waves rolling onto a beach. He was adrift in the clouds, a thick white comforter, puffy white pillows, a thick white bedspread piled at his feet. The queen-sized bed was topped with a white canopy. He knew where he was, but it took a few minutes to convince himself he was really there. The walls were adorned with cheap pastels of beach scenes. The floor was painted wood. He listened to the ocean and heard the distant calls of seagulls. There were no other sounds, quite a contrast to the early bustle of Chelsea. No alarm clock startling him at some obscene hour. No rush to shower and dress and hurry through the frantic rituals of getting to the office. None of that. At least not today. This was not an unpleasant way to begin the rest of his life. The bedroom was one of three in a modest two-story beach rental an hour east of Destin, Florida, on the Gulf, 2 hours and 48 minutes by Learjet from Teterboro Airport in New Jersey. They, he and his new friends, had landed at Destin just before 4 a.m. A van with armed drivers had scooped them up and raced along Highway 98, passing miles of empty condos and beach houses and small hotels. There were a few vacationers, judging by the parking lots, and many of the cars had Canadian license plates. The two windows were half open, and the breeze blew the curtains. It was a full 3 minutes before Kyle thought about Benny, but he fought the temptation and concentrated on the distant squawking of the seagulls. There was a slight knock at the door.
Yes,
Kyle answered with a scratchy voice. It opened slightly, and Todd, his new best friend, wedged through his chubby face and said,
You wanted a 10 o'clock wake-up call?
Thanks.
You okay?
Sure. Todd had joined the escape in Destin and was now assigned to guard their witness or snitch or whatever Kyle was considered to be. He was from the Pensacola office, went to Auburn, was only 2 years older than Kyle himself, and talked far more than any other FBI agent, real or fake, that he'd met so far in this ordeal. Kyle, in boxers only, left the softness of the clouds and went next door to the large kitchen den combo. Todd had been to the grocery store. The counter was covered with boxes of cereal, breakfast snacks, cookies, chips, all manner of boxed foods.
Coffee?
Todd asked.
Sure.
There were a few items of folded clothing on the kitchen table. Kyle's other new best friend was Barry, an older, quieter type with premature gray hair and more wrinkles than any 40-year-old should have. Barry said,
Good morning. We've been shopping. Bought you a couple of t-shirts, shorts, a pair of khakis, deck shoes. Really nice stuff from the local Kmart. Don't worry, Uncle Sam paid the bill.
I'm sure I'll look fabulous, Kyle said, taking a cup of coffee from Todd. Todd and Barry, both in khakis and polos, were unarmed but not far from their weapons. There was also a Nick and a Matthew somewhere close by. I gotta call the office, Kyle said. Check in, you know, tell them I'm sick and can't work today. By now they're already looking for me. Todd produced the firm phone and said,
Be our guest. We're told it's secure. Just don't give a hint as to where you are. Agreed?
Where am I?
Western Hemisphere.
Close enough. With his coffee and his phone,
Kyle stepped outside onto a wide deck that looked over some dunes. The beach was long and beautiful and deserted. The air was light, brisk, but far warmer than frigid New York. With great reluctance, he looked at the phone. Emails, texts, and voicemails from Doug Peckham, Dale, Sherry Abney, Tim Reynolds, Tabor, and a few others, but nothing to alarm him. He scanned them quickly, just the usual daily barrage of communications from very wired people with too much access to each other. Dale asked twice if he was okay. He called Doug Peckham, got his voicemail, and reported that he was down with the flu, flat on his back, sick as a dog, and so on. Then he called Dale, who was in a meeting. He left the same message. One useless advantage of working with workaholics was that they had no time to worry about each other's minor ailments. Got the flu? Take some pills and sleep it off, but do not spread your germs at the office. Roy Benedict seemed to be waiting by the phone. "Where are you, Kyle?" he asked, almost in a pant. "Western Hemisphere?" "I'm doing well. How about you?" "Fine. You safe?" "Safe. I'm hidden, stashed away, and I'm guarded by a posse of at least four, all anxious to shoot someone." "Any news on our man Benny?" "No. They'll have indictments by noon, and they're adding one for murder. They'll splash these around the world and hope for a break. You were right. Your apartment had more bugs than a landfill. Good stuff, too. The latest in wiretapping technology." "I'm honored." "And they found a transmitter in the rear bumper of your Jeep."
"I never thought of that."
"Anyway, all this is being presented to the grand jury as we speak, so at least Benny will have a thick indictment on record should he ever make a mistake."
"Don't bet on that."
"Have you talked to the law firm?"
"I left a message with Peckham, the flu routine. He'll buy it for a couple of days."
"No alarms? Nothing strange?"
"No. It's weird, Roy. I'm 1,000 miles away now, and looking back, I can't believe how easy it was to walk in with the right gear and walk out with the files. I could have taken every single document in the database, 4 million plus, and handed them over to Benny or another thug, and I could have gone back into my office this morning as if nothing happened.
Scully has got to be warned." "So who tells them?"
"I do. I have a few things to get off my chest."
"Let's talk about that tomorrow. I've been on the phone with Bullington all morning. Twice he's mentioned the witness protection program. The FBI is pushing it hard. They are pretty nervous about you, Kyle."
"I'm nervous about me too, but witness protection?"
"Sure. You're convinced they can't find Benny. They're convinced they can. If they do, and they haul him back for a trial with an incredible list of charges, then you're the star. If you're not around to testify, then the government's case falls flat."
A pleasant morning at the beach was becoming complicated.
And why not? Nothing had been simple for a long time now.
"That'll take some serious thought and consideration," Kyle said.
"Then start thinking."
"I'll call you later."
Kyle dressed in the khakis and a t-shirt, not a bad fit, then ate 2 bowls of cereal. He read the Pensacola News Journal and the New York Times. The Times had nothing about last night's excitement at the Oxford Hotel.
"Of course not," Kyle said to himself. "It happened far too late, and it was far too clandestine." Then why was he looking for it?
After breakfast and the papers, Todd joined him at the kitchen table.
"We have a few rules,"
he said, with a jovial face but a hard smile. "What a surprise."
"You can make calls, obviously, but only on that phone. Can't reveal your whereabouts. You can walk on the beach, but we have to follow, at a distance."
"You're kidding." "I'm walking down the beach, and there's a guy with a machine gun tagging along."
"How relaxing."
Todd caught the humor and enjoyed a laugh.
"No machine gun, and we won't be conspicuous."
"You're all conspicuous. I can spot an agent a mile away."
"Anyway, stay close to the house."
"How long will I be here?" Todd shrugged and said,
"I have no idea."
"Am I in protective custody or witness protection?"
"Custody, I think."
"You don't know, Todd?"
"Come on. Custody implies that I'm a suspect of some variety, doesn't it, Todd?"
Another shrug.
"But I'm not a suspect. I'm a witness, but I have not agreed to enter the witness protection program. So according to my lawyer, the one I just talked to, I'm free to walk out that door anytime I want. What do you think about that, Todd?"
"That machine gun you just mentioned?
We have at least 6 on the premises. So I should stay here, right?"
"Right."
"Okay. It's noon. What are we going to do?"
Barry had been hovering nearby, not missing a word. He walked to the table with a large basket of the usual board games the owners of all beach rentals leave behind. Barry said, "We have Monopoly, Risk, Rook, Scrabble, Chinese checkers. Your call, Kyle." Kyle studied the basket.
Scrabble.
Chapter 41. The flu raged unabated into Friday. Doug Peckham, while claiming to be sympathetic, was curious about any improvement. They were getting hammered with motions in the Trilon case, and everyone was needed. His sympathy did not extend to a curiosity about where Kyle was staying, who, if anyone, was tending to him, what medications he was taking, and so on. Part of Kyle's ruse was the forbidding diagnosis that his particular strain of the flu was hotly contagious. Since New York was going through its annual December flu warning, his story was easily digestible. Dale believed it too, though she was much more sympathetic. The temperature hit 80 degrees in the early afternoon, and Kyle was bored with the beach house. He said to Todd, "I'd like to take a walk. Would you please prepare the beach?"
"My pleasure. Which way are you going?"
"East, toward Miami."
"I'll round up the gang. They're getting bored with you."
Kyle walked for an hour and passed fewer than 10 beachcombers going the opposite way. 30 yards behind him were two of his guardians, a male and a female, a happy couple with receivers in their ears and handguns in their pockets. He heard music and saw a small crowd under a fake thatched roof. It was the Gator Hotel, a 1950s-style mom-and-pop motel with a small pool and low rates, a depressing little place, but it had the only action on the beach. Just for the hell of it, and to torment his followers, he sauntered away from the water, walked between two small dunes, and pulled up a chair at Pedro's Bar. Jimmy Buffett was singing softly about life in a banana republic. The bartender was mixing rum punch specials. The crowd numbered 7, all over the age of 60, all overweight, all chatting in crisp northern accents. The early snowbirds. Kyle sipped a rum punch and ordered a cigar. Between the dunes, he saw his trailing couple stop and gawk and try to figure out what to do. Within minutes, another agent appeared from the front of the motel. He walked through the open bar, winked at Kyle, and kept going. "We're here, buddy." He drank and smoked for a while and tried to convince himself that he was relaxed. No worries. Just another overworked professional enjoying a few days at the beach. But there was too much unfinished business in New York. After 3 days of thorough protection, Kyle was fed up. The Lear landed at Teterboro just after 6 p.m. on Saturday, December 6th. At Kyle's insistence, he was booked into a suite at the Tribeca Grand Hotel, between Walker and White, near the village. And at his request, all FBI agents remained below, in the lobby and atrium. He was tired of their overkill and silly rules. Silly, in his opinion. Dale arrived promptly at 8. She was driven over by 2 agents and sneaked in through a service entrance. When they were alone, Kyle started with the fake flu and worked his way backward. It was a long journey, and she listened with the same disbelief that had been shared by Roy Benedict and John McAvoy. They ordered room service, lobster and a fine white burgundy, compliments of the government, and kept talking. He was leaving the firm, and not sure where he was headed. She was leaving the firm, a nice lateral transfer to a better life in downtown Providence. He wanted to talk about her future, but she was determined to finish up with his past. She found it fascinating, incredulous, frightening, and said over and over, "Why didn't you tell me?" The best response he could offer was, "I didn't tell anyone." They talked until well past midnight. The back and forth was more a conversation between 2 good friends than between 2 casual lovers. They said goodbye with a long kiss and a serious promise to meet in a few weeks, as soon as Kyle settled some issues. At 1 a.m., he called downstairs and informed the boys that he was going to sleep. Kyle McAvoy entered the opulent offices of Scully and Pershing for the last time at noon on Sunday. He was accompanied by Roy Benedict, Mr. Mario Delano of the FBI, and Mr. Drew Wingate with the Department of Justice. They were led to a conference room on the 35th floor,
yet another room Kyle had never seen. They were met by half a dozen of the firm's partners, all with very somber faces. All offered stiff introductions. Only Doug Peckham showed the slightest trace of warmth to Kyle, and only for a second. They took seats on opposite sides of the table like enemies glaring across the battlefield. Howard Meeser, the managing partner, Peckham, Wilson Rush, who looked particularly upset, a retired legend named Abraham Kintz, and two slightly younger partners from the firm's management committee, men Kyle had never laid eyes on. Late Saturday evening, Roy Benedict had sent them a 25-page detailed summary of Kyle's big adventure, and there was little doubt that every word had been read more than once by all six of the partners. Attached to the narrative was Kyle's letter of resignation. Meeser kicked things off with a pleasant, "Mr. McAvoy, your resignation is unanimously accepted." Not just accepted, but unanimously so. Kyle nodded, but said nothing. "We've read the summary prepared by your lawyer," Meeser said slowly, methodically. "It is fascinating and troubling, and it raises a number of questions. I suggest we address them in order of priority." "Fine, fine, yes, agreed," all around the table. "The first issue is what to do with you, Mr. McAvoy. We understand the reasons behind your theft, but it was a theft nonetheless. You took the confidential files of a valuable client for purposes that had not been authorized by this firm. A criminal prosecution is in order. Do you agree?" Kyle had been told to keep his mouth shut unless Roy approved a response. "A criminal prosecution is possible," Roy admitted. "But there is nothing to be gained. The firm lost nothing." "Loss is not a requirement, Mr. Benedict." "Agreed, technically. But let's be practical. Kyle had no intention of turning over the documents once he'd taken them. He did so only to stop a conspiracy to seriously harm this firm and its client." "The FBI will not cooperate in a criminal prosecution, Mr. Meeser," Devono said, the heavy hand of the federal government.
"Nor will the Department of Justice," added Wingate.
"Thank you," Meeser said. "But we don't need your help. Theft can be a state charge, and we have some nice contacts with the authorities here in the city. However, we are not inclined to pursue this as a criminal matter." Heavy emphasis on the word criminal. "There is little to be gained and much to be lost. We don't want our clients worried about confidentiality, and this little episode would make a wonderful story in the press."
Wilson Rush was glaring at Kyle, but Doug occupied himself with a legal pad. He was there because Kyle fell under his immediate supervision, and because the firm needed bodies, a grim show of force at this unfortunate moment. Kyle watched Doug, ignored Rush, and wondered how many of the six partners over there were billing Trilon at a double rate since they'd been dragged in on a Sunday. Billing. Billing. He hoped he never saw another timesheet, never again glanced at his watch and divided an hour into tenths, never again tallied things up at the end of the month to make sure he'd gone over 200 hours, padding here and there if he came up a few hours short.
"As to the matter of ethics," Meeser was saying, "this is a serious breach of a client's confidence. The State Disciplinary Committee should be notified."
He paused long enough for someone on the other side to respond.
"I thought you were trying to avoid publicity," Roy said. "These matters are supposed to be private, but we know that they're often leaked. And if Kyle gets reprimanded or disbarred, it becomes public record. A Scully and Pershing associate disbarred for taking confidential files? Is that the story you want splashed in the New York Lawyer?"
At least four of the six were slowly shaking their heads, and it dawned on Kyle that they were as nervous as he was. Their vaunted reputation was on the line. A major client might pull its business. Others could follow. Scully's competitors would use the breach of security as a piece of delicious gossip to spread all over Wall Street.
"Do you plan to stay in New York, Mr. McAvoy?" Meeser asked.
Roy nodded, and Kyle said, "No, I can't."
"Very well. If you agree to forego the practice of law in the state of New York, we will agree to forget the ethical violations."
"Agreed," Kyle said, and maybe a bit too quickly,
because he couldn't wait to leave the city. Meeser shuffled through some notes as if there were a dozen tough topics to cover, but the meeting was practically over. The meeting was important so that the firm could officially dismiss Kyle, perhaps flog him a bit, listen to his apology, and then both sides could say good riddance.
"Where is this blue box?" Wilson Rush asked.
"Locked in my office," Roy said.
"And it has nothing but the Category A files?"
"That's correct," Roy said.
"I'd like for our security people to see it."
"Any time."
"But we would like to be present," Delano added. "If this Benny character is caught, the box is exhibit number one."
"Any progress on the search?"
Meeser asked, veering off script. Delano could never say there was no progress when searching for a suspect, so he gave the standard,
"We are pursuing leads. We're still confident."
In other words, no. More shuffling of paper, more shifting of rear ends.
"In your summary, Mr. McAvoy, you allude to additional security issues within Scully and Pershing. Care to expand on this?"
A nod from Roy, and Kyle began. "Yes, but first I want to apologize for my actions. I hope you understand the reasons behind what I did, but I was still wrong, and I apologize. As far as security, I met with these thugs 10 times while I was in New York. The first meeting was in February. The 10th meeting was last Tuesday night. I took meticulous notes of each meeting, dates, places, duration, who was present, what was said, everything I could remember afterward. My attorney has these notes. The FBI has a copy. On 3 occasions, I was given information that could only be known by someone within this firm. I think there's another spy. For example, Benny, and I hate to use that name because it's just an alias, but it's all we have. But Benny knew about the warehouse full of documents, down south, as he said. During one meeting, he and Nigel, another alias, hinted that they were making progress in breaching the security of the warehouse. They knew about the secret room on the 18th floor. Benny knew every name of every partner and associate assigned to the lawsuit. Benny knew that a young lawyer named McDougal was leaving, that he worked under a senior associate named Sherry Abney on the Trilon case, and Benny told me to start playing squash because Sherry enjoyed the game. Benny handed me copies of pleadings, motions, rulings. I have over 600 pages of the court file that, as you know, is locked away and kept from the public. 3 of the 6 jaws had dropped on the other side. Not down to their chests, not the kick-me-in-the-gut shock of sudden, horrific news, but a stunning blow nonetheless. The nightmare of one lowly associate tapping into their impenetrable defenses was bad enough. Now there might be another? And just to give them more heartburn, Kyle added something he truly believed, but couldn't prove. "And I don't think it's an associate," he said, then withdrew from the fray and settled back into his chair. All 6 partners had the same thought. If it's not an associate, then it must be a partner. Doug Peckham swallowed hard, cleared his throat, and attempted to speak.
"Are you saying?"
Next to him, Wilson Rush quickly raised his right hand, partially in Doug's space. Like a king calling for silence, a quick lifting of the hand, and all was quiet for the moment. Roy finally said, "Anything else?"
"I believe that's all," Meeser said.
After an awkward few seconds, Roy stood, followed by Kyle and Delano and Wingate. The 6 partners did not budge. They sat frozen, with matching scowls, as Kyle and his little entourage left the room. Chapter 42. In the lobby of the building, they were met by the same 3 large young men who'd brought Kyle from the hotel. The group made it safely outside, onto Broad Street, then walked 1 block east to the building next door, where Roy worked, 16 floors up. The 3 agents, bodyguards really, camped in a reception area and began waiting again. Inside Roy's office, Drew Wingate decided that his job was over. He excused himself and promised to help in any way possible. After he left, Kyle, Roy, and Delano gathered around Roy's small conference table. Some poor secretary, beckoned on a Sunday, served them coffee with a smile.
"What are your plans, Kyle?" Delano asked.
"Well, looks like I won't be practicing law in the state of New York, that's for sure."
I'll go home for a few weeks, take some time off, enjoy the holidays.
I'm not sure that's a wise thing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Delano. I appreciate your concern, but I'm not about to go into hiding. Thanks for the offer to enter the dark little world of witness protection, but no thanks. I'm 25 years old, stumbling but not falling, and I'll do just fine on my own.
Roy's coffee cup froze in midair, halfway to his mouth.
Kyle, you can't be serious.
Dead serious, Roy. No pun intended. I've just survived 3 days of protection, guards all around me, hiding and watching for bad guys. No thanks. There's more to my future than fake names and nonstop Scrabble.
Scrabble?
Don't go there.
Listen, I've been under surveillance for the last 10 months. You know what that does to you? You get real paranoid. You suspect everyone. You seize upon every new face because it might belong to a bad guy. You notice every corner, alley, every bum on a park bench, every guy wearing a dark trench coat. You pick up a phone and you wonder who's listening. You send an email and change the wording because the wrong eyes might see it. In your own apartment, you change clothes in a hurry, back to the camera, trying to hide your crotch. You walk in a coffee shop and go straight to the front window to see who's on the sidewalk behind you. You learn all sorts of stupid little tricks because the more you know, the more you might need to know. And the walls close in. The world becomes a small place because somebody is always watching. I'm sick of it. I'm not going to live on the run.
These guys killed Baxter Tate without the slightest hesitation, Roy said. What makes you think they won't do the same to you?
The operation was still hot when Baxter came barging in. The operation, at least the part that involves me, is now over. Benny's gone. The operation failed. He might return with another plan.
I'm sure he will, Delano said.
But it won't involve me. What does Benny gain by taking me out?
He takes out a material witness, Roy said.
Only if he's caught, which I seriously doubt. If Benny gets hauled back for a trial, then we can talk about hiding.
Oh, it'll be too late then, Kyle, Delano said. Believe me, the moment Benny gets nabbed, there'll be a few guys headed your way.
Bring him on. We have at least 5 deer rifles at home. I'll carry a Luger in my briefcase. If they show up, we'll have a regular gunfight.
Get serious, Kyle, Roy pleaded.
The decision has been made. The FBI cannot force me into witness protection, and so I hereby, officially and respectfully, say no. Thank you, Mr. Delano. But the answer is no.
I hope you don't regret this, Delano said.
So do I, Kyle said. And please don't follow me around. I might go berserk and shoot the next person I see lurking in the shadows.
Oh, don't worry. We have plenty of work elsewhere.
Delano stood and all hands were shaken. He said to Roy,
I'll check in once a week with an update.
Roy walked him to the door, and the FBI left Kyle's life. With the door closed, Roy took his seat and looked at Kyle as if he couldn't believe it.
You're awfully brave, he said.
Brave or stupid, the line is often blurred.
Why not disappear for a few months, maybe a year? Let everything cool off.
A year means nothing. These guys have long memories. If Benny wants revenge, he'll find me sooner or later, and it won't matter where I happen to be.
You don't trust the FBI?
No. I trust you, me, my father, a girl named Dale, and that's about it.
So it was an inside job?
We'll never know, will we? I have a hunch that Benny works for the same government you and I send our taxes to. That's how he got away. That's why he'll never be found.
I still don't believe that.
Kyle shrugged, and for a long time, nothing was said. Finally, Kyle glanced at his watch. Look, Roy, it's Sunday afternoon, and you have a family. Go home.
What about you?
Me? I'm walking out the door, taking a long hike to my apartment, not once looking over my shoulder, and when I get there, I'll load up my clothes and as much junk as possible, cram all of it into my Jeep that has 200,000 miles on the odometer, and drive home. I should get there in time for a late dinner with my father. Tomorrow, he and I will draw up a partnership agreement. McAvoy and McAvoy, attorneys at law. And I'll make partner faster than any graduate in the history of the Yale Law School.
I like it,
The editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal, practicing law on Main Street in York, Pennsylvania.
I like it, too.
Real clients. Real people. Real cases. Deer hunting on Saturdays, Steelers on Sundays. A real life.
You're not kidding, are you?
I have never been more serious.
Come on. I'll walk you out.
They rode the elevator to the lobby and walked out of the building. They shook hands and said goodbye, and Roy watched his client stride nonchalantly along Broad Street and disappear around a corner.
This is Eric Singer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Associate by John Grisham. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. This program was recorded and edited at John Marshall Sound. Text, copyright 2009 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production, copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.